we're very consistently using full recourse debt. And so I think that sets us apart. And that's something I think every LP should ask a sponsor, right? Is this recourse debt? Is it carve out guarantees? We sign full recourse. And that is the principals here, the partners here at MAC Capital Partners, they sign personal liability on the loan. So I think that's really influential for a lot of people, especially with more experience, as they look at that and they go, okay, there's a lot more skin in the game than just the 5% co-invest.
Welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate podcast, where we talk to the experts in all asset classes of commercial real estate. Listen so you can grow your wealth, expand your portfolio, improve your mindset, and live an amazing life. And now, your host, Jonathan Hayek.
Welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate, where we talk to the experts in non-residential commercial real estate so you can grow your business, find a competitive advantage, and use real estate to live the life that you want. I'm your host, Jonathan Hayek, and today I am talking with Drew Walgren of MAG Capital. Mr. Walgren serves as Vice President of Investor Relations, managing both equity and lending relationships at MAG Capital. Drew joined MAG in 2019 after 8 successful years as a risk analyst at Liberty Mutual Insurance. He holds a bachelor's degree in finance from Cal State University, and Drew lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area with his wife, 3 children, and he enjoys the outdoors with his family. Drew, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Great to see you again, Jonathan. Thanks for having me, and I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Thank you again for joining me. Really looking forward to this conversation. I think investors, operators, we can all learn a ton from MAG Capital. I've long believed that you guys are operating on a completely different level. So sincerely looking forward to getting some expertise from you all. Drew, I read a little bit about your background in the intro. Why don't we start out by you telling us a little bit more about your background and what your work looks like today?
Sure. I mean, I'll give you a little way back, but I had the entrepreneurial bug way back. Well, really, I was raised in a family of parents who ran an automotive shop themselves, right? So I would work summers in there. I think that, you know, sometimes is a good foundation for people to see their family do it. And then at the tender age of 20 years old, I actually worked with a friend and essentially managed the owner of a small beverage and snack distribution company. We basically ran his company for him. He's a serial entrepreneur, and his largest business was a chain of about 36 ice cream shops. And he had this ice cream factory and warehouse. And we sort of shared his warehouse with all of our drinks. One day he goes, "Hey, you guys should just buy this from me. I want more room for sugar and raw materials and all this. I don't care about this business," right? So he sold it to us for basically very cheap, right? Basically the cost of the equipment and inventories, delivery vans, and that was it for me. I was 20. I actually pulled out of college at that time because I said, this makes way more sense. And, you know, we're talking about mid-2000s here for me. And I, you know, went right in and, you know, working 14, 16-hour days sometimes. And it was so much fun, you know, before any of us were married or had families at that time. And we had a blast. We hired our friends. We did, you know, we made all the mistakes, you know, all those things and still made money, but that's how you learn a ton. And, you know, fast forward to 3-4 years later, the crash happens, you know, 40% of my customers go out of business. And I essentially, my partner just walked away. He just found a new life for himself. And I couldn't even sell the business at that time. And I went back to school and finished and then kind of went into the corporate world. But during that time, really, the real estate piece came in early 2010s, bought first house. It was a total fixer-upper, and I had more time than I did money at the time, so I did, and skills. So I went ahead and fixed that up, add a lot of value, and several times of doing that during a very lucky upswing, I'll be honest. I put in a little bit of hard work and got a lot of luck, and really was faced with that decision whether to keep properties and rent them out. And my brother at the time was working for a commercial real estate shop, raising capital, really partnering, co-GPing with operators like MAG Capital Partners, actually. And that's where that relationship kind of started and how I met them. And I decided not to hold on to real estate and start investing proceeds right into passive real estate investments because I was seeing opportunity in my career at the time, this corporate career with Liberty Mutual Insurance. was moving up, I felt really good about it. I wanted to keep my focus there. So for me, that made a lot of sense. And at that time, really started to shift more capital into passive investments, and I never looked back. So later on, Neil, who had a long relationship with the founding partners here at MAG, in about 2019, him and I both jumped on board and really built out an internal capital raising side. As in the past, they had partnered with other groups to bring in equity. And so today we're a vertically integrated investment shop that's really built that piece out that was a little bit missing at the time, or at least didn't have the scale that it had. So that's my background and sort of how I landed here. So last 5 years have been great. We've seen a ton of growth and happy to, you know, continue networking and growing our investor group with people who are interested in this, you know, this team and the strategy that we have.
Such an interesting and varied background. We could probably talk for an hour just about that little distribution company and lessons learned. I'd love to have a separate conversation with you about that. For now, let's focus on MAG Capital Partners. Tell us who MAG Capital is, your business strategy, the types of deals you're doing, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, MAG Capital Partners, we're a commercial real estate investment shop that focuses on single tenant, triple net lease industrial real estate, typically with long-term leases backed by American manufacturing companies and food producers. We also have a separate wing and an interest in small and medium cap industrial operating companies as well. But, you know, to keep things a little bit more focused, we could talk about real estate. Really, that's our core product that we've been focused on the last 8 or 9 years here now.
So you mentioned a single tenant. Do you only do single tenant properties, or do you have multi-tenant properties as well?
Very few. It's exceptions. There are many exceptions to that focus that we have. I'd say about 75% of our portfolio is single tenant industrial. We own a little bit of single tenant net lease retail. When those opportunities come up, make sense. We are opportunistic. We own a small portfolio of multifamily properties in the Inland Empire in a JV relationship that we have with the property management company there. So we really are opportunistic. And I think that a lot of that comes from the founding principals here. They both were in brokerage a long time, CCIM designations. They've underwritten, you know, thousands of deals and many in different asset classes. So really a lot of experience there, but we really keep our focus on the industrial side. And a lot of that just comes from reputation and deal flow that now comes to us. That momentum builds over time as a sponsor group, right? Those brokers you have a relationship understand that you have experience here and you can close and execute, and you know that, you know, leads to more opportunities.
So I also love single tenant industrial properties, and the most common pushback I get from people outside this asset class is single tenant, what if it goes vacant? Your vacancy is binary. Either you're 100% occupied or 100% vacant. So I have no doubt you all get that same pushback. So what's your answer to people that give you the pushback against single tenant properties?
Yeah, I completely understand the concern. When you first look at it, it's terrifying. You say, oh my gosh, I could have just completely empty building with no plan for the next to fill this thing up. Or how can I get out of this? Oh my gosh, I'm going to lose everything in this property. I'm going to get foreclosed on. So I completely get it. The other side of the coin and having a single tenant in there is really the insights and inside look into the tenant that we get. We're able to look at their financials. We're able to, you know, in our strategy, we do a lot of sale leasebacks, which I'm sure we'll get to here, but we're able to really understand the corporate dynamic, how long they've been there, spread their financials, and you have a lot more recourse with the corporation, right? If I have 100 unit apartment building and, you know, Johnny in apartment 101 says, I'm homesick, right? I'm going to go move back with my mom in the East Coast or something. That can happen, right? And you don't really have a lot of recourse, and you're going to chalk it up to, okay, you know, here's some lost revenue. I'm going to go ahead and re-tenant this, and it's not going to be a huge deal, right? That's 1% of your occupancy there. So for us, we have a lot more recourse, and typically these tenants are, sometimes I hate this term, but they're sticky, right? They have a lot invested into these properties. Tens of millions of dollars in equipment installed is very difficult to move. And typically we're signing long-term leases with them. So, you know, we're not interested in looking at a release opportunity every 3 years, 5 years, or even 10 years. Typically we're signing 15, 20-year leases with these tenants. So that gives us a lot of security there. You know, I could do another 20 minutes on the subject, but essentially that's the big difference there is you were able to see a lot more to get comfortable with a single tenant being in place.
To give listeners an idea of the scale at which MAG is operating, can you give us an idea of assets under management, typical purchase price, those sorts of things?
Yeah, we're in the mid 900 millions or so in assets under management. So a few acquisitions from now, you know, Q2 or so, we'll probably be crossing over that $1 billion marker. You know, I don't want to come off as a guy who's just counting here, but it's a little significant, especially in the capital raising side. You sort of, you know, break the sound barrier when it comes to institutional capital a bit, and all of a sudden you're taken a little bit more seriously. So that does have real world effects on our business. But really at this point, it's something low 90s. Sorry, it's always changing. You know, we just had 4 closings in December all clustered together. So somewhere around 90 individual properties under management. We've gone full cycle on over 30 deals with our investor group. So, you know, we've had quite a bit of, as Brian Burke says over at Praxis, you know, taking off in the plane and landing the plane successfully.
Great. Let's go into the typical deals that you're doing. You talked about sale leaseback. You talked about long-term leases. It might be helpful to just talk about a kind of deal that's middle of the fairway. What's the ideal deal that you all are looking at and looking to close?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example without getting too specific with names. We just closed on a deal in Vermont. And in this case, it was a sale leaseback, as the majority of these investments we make are a sale leaseback transaction, where we're actually buying the property from the actual business who owns and operates within this real estate. So they're selling the property, and simultaneously at closing, we're signing a long-term lease. So in this case, again, I'll stay away from names here, but it's a company that manufactures gravestones, headstones, and other granite, you know, artwork, actually, accessories, all sorts of granite products, but namely in the death care industry. They've been in business for over 120 years in Vermont, situated very close to a strategically next to one of the deepest, they called it, I think it's called a deep well granite quarry, which is right nearby. It makes a lot of sense. But in this case, they're being acquired by a private equity group. And this is pretty common for us, either simultaneous or after a private equity group acquires this portfolio business. They are now looking to spin off the real estate, access those proceeds or that equity that was tied up in that real estate, and use it to either lower their cost of acquisition of the business or use that as a financing tool to inject into the company to grow it, right? Capital is a fuel for growth, and these private equity groups look at it a lot like some commercial real estate value add operators, right? So in this case, it was simultaneous to a private equity group who loved this company, wanted to purchase it, add it to their portfolio. And they said, we don't want to tie up our capital in the real estate, right? They're in the business of investing in companies, not real estate. They see a higher rate of return in their specialty, which is operating company investments. So in this case, we worked really closely with them. And at closing of the acquisition of the business, we simultaneously did a sale leaseback. So it's kind of a tricky and finely timed transaction, which is really where our experience comes in for sellers, where they go, look, we need someone with experience who knows how to hit this, who won't come up with excuses. Because oftentimes we're part of a smaller part of a larger transaction, right? So failure is not an option. You really need to be able to execute there. And that gives us really some leverage in pricing. We're able to come in and get a cap rate you might think is unattainable. But for the seller, execution is more important than level of proceeds. They need someone who can do that. You know, they could go get a bridge loan for this and get more time. That's very costly as well. So for them, this is a very clean, easy way to get the transaction done. And in this case, a private equity group wanted to keep their cost of the acquisition lower. Again, they didn't want to tie up capital in real estate. So really a good example. Not all of the acquisitions we make are simultaneous to it, but many times following after mergers and acquisitions in the private equity side. So hopefully that's a good example, but you know, we see many of those opportunities. And yeah, those ones are, you know, you're kind of hitting a moving target, right? Because you're really following their closing timeline. So again, usually you can get some additional spread in those situations, which we did.
Working with a granite fabricator in the Granite State makes a lot of sense. I think Vermont is called the Granite State. You did a really good job of explaining the benefit of a sale leaseback to the seller, but will you talk about it from MAG Capital Partners' perspective? Why does MAG really like the strategy of the sale leaseback?
Yeah, great question. A couple things. One is that we're able to craft our own lease. You can go out and buy single tenant industrial properties with a lease in place, and you're going to inherit that lease. And that might be okay, right? But we see the contractual value that we're able to create on the front end of a sale leaseback, executing a very institutional grade lease with things like quarterly financial reporting, annual rent bumps. These are some of the things that we know institutional buyers on the back end will value. In fact, they're non-starters for a lot of them. So part of that is to protect us as well. But part of that is because we understand seeing our way out of this deal, this is going to be crafted and structured in a way that's really attractive to an end buyer. I've seen some goofy leases out there that are in place, and we've walked away from most of them, those goofy leases at least, where, hey, you know, first rent bump is in 3 years from now, next rent bump is in 6 years later after that, and it might be a 25% rent bump, right? But you know, for a buyer, you might have a publicly traded REIT. They want to be able to show their shareholders annual revenue increases, right? So that's important to them. They don't want flatline revenue here. So you could see why that's attractive to a more institutional, publicly traded group like that. So that's something that we really enjoy. And again, we're able to create some contractual value at the front end of this transaction. Sort of, you know, within a couple of years, this kind of asset would trade at a slightly lower cap rate with an institutional lease in place versus a sale leaseback. So we like that piece. And the other part is being at the front end of a really long lease. Typically, these are 20-year leases, sometimes 15 years. So we're able to enjoy that really predictable yield on the front end. You know, we have, these are absolute triple net leases where the tenant takes care of all the responsibilities, long-term commitment with 100% occupancy, and pairing all that with fixed rate debt, it's very predictable yield. We enjoy that. And then 5-6 years later, if we want to sell at that time, there's still 15 years left on that lease. Now, 5 years later, if the market looks terrible due to whatever macro black swan events are happening at the time, hopefully not. But if they are, we're in a really comfortable position to just continue to hold, right? There's 15 years left on that lease. Cash flow has been increasing every year. As again, annual rent bump. So it gives you a nice position and your back isn't against the wall at a projected exit time, because we all know, you know, what's the Mike Tyson quote? You know, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face. You know, that's pretty much it. So it gives us a lot of flexibility, whereas other people with shorter term debt, with shorter term leases, now are scrambling and starting to panic because now, you know, I mean, now's a perfect example, right? Rates are higher and people are faced with either refinancing at a higher rate or selling at a higher cap rate. And it's not attractive, either option. So I really enjoy that flexibility. So that's another piece. I'd say those are the top two reasons.
And are you all only focused on sale leasebacks? Do you do any ground up development? Do you buy any vacant properties and backfill? Any other strategies in the MAG Capital repertoire?
Sure. Yeah. Built to suit developments, something we really like. We don't want to take up the lease up risk. We like the construction risk we can get comfortable with. We're doing a built to suit project right now for a Idaho based potato grower, one of the largest marketers of fresh potatoes in the country. And they want a hub in Dallas area. And here we are, you know, we've located a site. We're going to basically develop a rail spur so that they can transport by rail, you know, very heavy loads of potatoes out to this, you know, cleaning, sorting, and distribution center for them in central, you know, north central Texas here. So that's a great one. We've actually already done a transaction with this tenant in the past, and that led to this other opportunity. So It's a really nice one. We're really comfortable with the tenant. We like their business. Obviously, food is a really stable industry as far as demand goes. And, you know, we're, again, built-to-suit is fantastic for developers. You know, at the end of construction, we're going to get a certificate of occupancy, and we're going to execute this long-term lease. And that's a pre-negotiated rent, right? We're going to say, look, this is going to be at a percentage of construction costs, right? Ultimately, your cap rate, and typically you're going to get higher than if you're buying an existing property. So, you know, you have this value add mix, you know, that ends maybe 12, 14 months later with really stable cash flows from a long-term net lease with a tenant, in this case, that we already understand and really like.
All right. So we've got granite in Vermont. We've got potatoes from Idaho and Texas. So talk to me about markets. It seems like you all are operating all over the country. Are there certain markets that you like, certain markets that you stay out of? What's your strategy there?
Yeah, strategy is really look at the deal first and then do our due diligence on the market. You know, the brokers in this country that specialize in this field, they know us. They bring us these opportunities. They know we're not a 4% cap rate buyer of an Amazon warehouse. We're not interested in that. We like private credit businesses that we tend to see more yield from. And we can sort through and dig in the risk profile of these tenants. And that's where we find this risk-adjusted return that we feel is exceptional. So that being said, where are the opportunities, right? They are nationwide, but where do you see more of it? It's really the Midwest, the Rust Belt, the Southeast is growing more and more. Tennessee, Georgia, they have a lot of tax incentives. They're really great pro-business states. Alabama. So you see that Southeast is going to grow over time for sure, I think. But the Midwest still has just probably the hub of manufacturing in this country, all across from, you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin out to, you know, drawing a line directly east to Ohio, there's a ton of manufacturing out there, tons of privately held companies, many which are backed by private equity groups, and many are still family owned. But they're manufacturing everything from, you know, widgets, right? Metal tubular parts, fiberglass tanks, you know, you name it, right? I mean, chemical coatings for lighting systems. I mean, there's all kinds of industries that you and I don't know about. Most people don't. And frankly, I really enjoy that part of our business is really seeing an opportunity and just diving in headfirst. Okay, who's a tenant? What's their business? Who are they selling to? Let's look at their debt levels. How do they, you know, how are they navigating the future? What's the competitive landscape? So it's pretty interesting just to kind of unfold those and really get to understand them and either get comfortable with it or maybe pass.
Drew, with over $900 million in assets and 90 properties, I imagine you've got some properties in small towns and probably some in larger metro areas as well. Is there a town that's too small, or is there a town that's too big for you all to invest in? How do you view risk in terms of buying a large property in a what could be a small town?
Yeah, great question. You know, we own properties from primary markets. I mean, Phoenix is one of our favorite markets for industrial real estate. We own quite a bit there. And we own really tertiary properties as well. And really, when you get to more risky markets, when you are more tertiary, you really have to look at the other risk factors, right? And in this investment strategy we have, I mean, obviously you have geographical risk, but credit risk is a huge one. And then at the end of the day, we're not buying a corporate bond, right? We're owning real estate. So a defensible basis can be very nice protected there. And you might say, well, look, this property is in a town of 10,000 people or less, right? And so you see something like that, you go, who's going to lease this? Many of these manufacturing sites are owned by ownership groups with offices in other places. This is where manufacturing in this country exists. They exist on the outskirts, just outside of major metropolitan areas or secondary markets, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or, you know, 45 minutes outside of Kansas City, where they have access to labor, they have access to transportation. Sometimes regionally, they're focused there because they have, you know, an industry that finds itself sort of centered around a region of the country, and they can service those customers by bringing them, you know, parts essentially that they manufacture or assemblies. So you start to look at that and you go, look, here, you know, what is the risk here of a, you know, a property with a tenant who's been operating, you know, on the outskirts of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, again, as that example, they've been there for 45 years. They do $100 million in revenue with 12% margins. They've been family owned for a long time, but were bought by a private equity four years ago. Now they've sort of added other expertises from their other portfolio companies, and they have a lot of capital behind them in case there's any speed bumps along the way. And so you start to look at that and you go, look, we're buying this at, you know, $60 a foot, let's say. Replacement cost for this is typically $120 to $180 bucks a foot. Metal buildings, I'm assuming here, you know, tilt up construction even higher. But okay, if we're at, you know, half of that replacement cost, we're in a great state. And obviously we're going to look at market rents, you know, if the market's at 5 and we're getting this at, you know, 4.25 per foot in rent, that's a really defensible basis on that real estate. We can, if we do lose this tenant, which is the ultimate fear, we have a much easier time re-tenanting a property like that with a low basis, or maybe even bringing in a new tenant at market rent and see a lot of upside there. So there's a lot more layers between buying a property with a single tenant and full Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And some of those are seeing blood in the water as we review financials periodically. But some other ones are really Chapter 11 as companies reorganize. And the last one before typically a Chapter 7 is a private equity buyout, right? Just like you see multifamily properties change hands when, hey, it's not really performing well, occupancy rate is low, the paint's peeling on the exterior. And some private equity, you know, a real estate syndicator will come in, buy it, inject equity, and turn the place upright because they have expertise and they have capital, access to capital there that they can use. So the same thing happens in the business world. And typically there's a lot of value with manufacturing companies. There's a lot of intellectual property that comes with them versus, you know, a retailer like JCPenney, right? You know, they've been in trouble for a while. What do they really offer outside of brand recognition?
At one point, I asked either you or your brother the same question about investing in small towns. And the response was, we actually kind of like investing in small towns because the properties that you're buying are responsible for a huge amount of employment in those small towns. And so if something were to happen, if the business were to be struggling, or if you had to re-tenant that property, that local town or state or county is going to do everything they possibly can to get, you know, to help you out and to try to get that stabilized. Because, you know, if this is a large property in a small town, it's likely responsible for a good deal of employment in that town. And so the local government is going to be highly motivated to try to stabilize that asset. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, it's more meaningful to the community, right? I mean, community and a city, county, state is not going to have ultimate control, right? At the end of the day, if a company is poorly managed, its, you know, industry is going to hell in a handbasket, it's not much they can do. But yeah, if there's temporary pain, if there's needs that a company has, and maybe it's for expansion, I mean, it could be who knows what, right? But if there's some influence that they can have on that, again, it's a lot more meaningful to those communities. And I think you saw that as a perfect example with COVID-19, right? You saw these companies in these smaller communities being allowed to continue to operate, less restrictions on them. And they really were in a better spot than the same company if it were placed in LA County, for instance, where they didn't care, right? They don't, you know, we all saw the news reports of small businesses just being shut down. And frankly, it was pretty unfair, right? You had large corporations that didn't get the same treatment. So in these communities, again, they're more meaningful. So, you know, it's hard to pin that down on a specific examples day to day, but COVID is a great one where, you know, we owned a lot of assets then and we called all these companies and it was a nice position that we were in. And frankly, a lot of that was because we're working with manufacturing tenants who aren't customer facing, right? It's a little different than brick and mortar retail. So we called them all individually. Hey, you know, Tommy, CFO at, you know, Jim's manufacturing company, whoever it was, tell us what's going on. Hey, we were shut down for a couple weeks. They let us open back up. We're back in. We're manufacturing. These parts are crucial to some of these industries that we're selling to. So the demand's there. And by the way, we're sitting on, you know, $20 million in cash on our balance sheet. We're fine, right? And so that's great stuff to hear. And a lot of that you owe to some of those smaller communities, which said, hey, we're not going to strangle our local business because of something like this. We're going to, you know, have some sensible policies and really think about this before we allow businesses and jobs to die.
Drew, I want to shift to talk about tenants and vetting tenants. I want to start off by asking, how common or typical is it that you have to re-tenant a property?
We've never re-tenanted a property. They're all sitting vacant. No, I'm just kidding. No, we've never had that. We've had one tenant out of a total of about 100 tenants that we've had in single tenant industrial properties, one default. And in that case, we worked through that. You know, they went to bankruptcy court. It was really a black swan situation. Tenant was operating really well, actually record revenues and profits, and had a huge event happen that they had a lot of liability for. And that's one of those black swan events, right? You can't plan for it, which is why, you know, again, going back to risk mitigation, what's the basis on your real estate? That's what I own, right? And how much value does this have without a tenant? What's the dark value of that property? So we actually sold that property as this company was effectively shutting down. They went through Chapter 7 bankruptcy. They weren't completely, they're going through this long process, but we actually never missed a rent payment from them during that, the course of that. So, you know, as companies, if they do go into bankruptcy court, you're in a very good position as a landlord. If it's Chapter 11 and they're reorganizing, frankly, if you're holding critical real estate, they're going to write off some debts. They're going to write off some other pieces that the bank is going to allow them to do, but they can't reject a lease unless they move out. So if you have their headquarters or a profitable site amongst, you know, maybe a dozen other ones, this is one, actually a judge won't even allow them to get out of a lease at a profitable center. They say, you can't touch this. This is a viable piece of your business. We're going to focus on the unviable parts of your business. And in Chapter 7, even during that time with that particular tenant, they still had equipment there. And the company was sitting on a pile of cash, and the judge is essentially figuring out who gets paid and who doesn't, right? And they said, look, as long as you have equipment in the site, you need to pay rent. And so during the course of that, we never missed a rent payment. We marketed the property. It was at a very good basis, and we sold it for a profit, essentially vacant, right? So, you know, time, inflation, of course, too, and you know, a good investment allowed us to exit, you know, one out of, again, around 100 of these with a profit, which is really something to say, given that we started with an occupied property and ended with essentially vacant. So I think that's a great story just to kind of emphasize that real estate basis being, you know, your underlying safety net.
A phrase that I'm seeing more commonly in this space is mission critical. And it sounds like that's kind of what that judge was looking at, is how important or critical to the company's overall strategy and operations is this property. So let's go into it. An integral part of your business is vetting tenants and underwriting tenants because, you know, they're so important to your strategy. So will you talk a little bit about whether it's the team members involved or the strategy in terms of vetting tenants? How do you know going into a large purchase that you are getting a great tenant?
Yeah, we've really built our team around this, right? This has been a focus, as I mentioned, 8-9 years or so now. And so, you know, as a real estate investment firm, if you're in a different asset class, you probably don't need a credit analyst or a team of credit analysts. We have 5 on our team, really, and a couple top guys that lead the process that came, you know, we hired these guys from publicly traded REITs. They came with 10 plus years of experience. Excuse me. And they really bring that experience in. And it's like an insurance policy, right? You really understand the risk because every tenant and their credit has risk, right? I don't care if it's Walmart or Amazon. Where is the risk coming from? What is the risk? And identifying that, understanding it is key, right? Because if you say, hey, there's just, I don't see any risk here, then you're going to get blindsided. You're going to get clocked in the back of the head. So for us, really looking at that, looking at the strengths and the weaknesses and, you know, finding, you know, if we can get comfortable there, that's really the process. And so it's a lot of factors, right? They're going to look at the financials is the most obvious one, but they spend, you know, dozens of hours on the phone interviewing the C-suite and a lot of these privately held corporations, right? I want to talk to CEO, CFO. I want to talk to the production manager on the floor. You know, what are things like here? Are you running out of space? You know, that might be an opportunity for us to develop an expansion there for them. We really want to understand where they've been historically, what the industry that they're in looks like, what it's going through, what's competitive landscape, right? Who are your top competitors? What do they do better than you? What do you do better than them? And of course, the industry itself, right? I mentioned Granite manufacturer in Vermont. They're in the death care industry. You go, okay, that's a pretty good, solid, you know, straight line demand, probably increasing over time. But, you know, one interesting factor to look at is, well, more people are being cremated as a percentage of total deaths this year. Okay, there's a potential risk, right? However, we see the next 20 years of a baby boomer generation that's going to be increasing the level of deaths in this country just because of how large that generation is. So, you know, you see all these and you have to weigh them against each other and really understand that. But, you know, debt is a huge one. Obviously, interest rates are higher. Okay, what's the debt structure look like? Do you have a revolving line of credit? You know, is it interest-only payments? What does that look like? What are the covenants on that debt? You know, you go to a bank and you get senior debt for your business, they're going to be covenants. They're going to say, look, you can't over-leverage yourself. You can't take on, you know, three times more than this in second position debt. You know, it really depends on the lender. So we're going to look at all that and understand that because, frankly, you know, you might say, you know, they don't have too much leverage, but they're brushing up against a covenant here due to X, Y, or Z. They could be in default of that loan that they borrowed against. So there's a lot there to unpack. And we produce internal credit memos and, you know, very institutional grade. And, you know, we share that with some of our investors who ask for it and want to dig in and do even further due diligence, and the banks that we work with to finance these and share all that. So it's a very long process. It's months, but it's really interesting. And you get to know a lot more about these companies. And going back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, here I am with a single tenant, but I know everything about them, you know, and that's a strength that you have that you don't always get. And something that an opportunity we get to learn because of a sale leaseback where, hey, the seller is this company. They're going to cooperate. And that's part of the offers we make on these properties is, hey, we want full access to, you know, to your financials and due diligence and full cooperation there. So if they want to get the deal done, we need to be able to see the full open kimono, as they say.
Drew, as we head towards the tail end of our conversation, there's one more topic that I want to ask you about that I think is fairly unique to MAG. And you all raise money, you all do these deals, you have limited partners, you have general partners, and you're dependent on limited partners to raise capital. And something that I always like to ask operators and look for in deals is how are interests aligned? So can you talk a little bit about how your deals are structured and how interests are aligned for both the general partners and the limited partners in these kinds of deals that you're doing?
Yeah, we didn't reinvent the wheel with the structure of most of these deals, right? And I think that's for good reason. I think over time, the industry has really, which is fairly new, right? Private syndicated investments is, you know, barely in its teenage years, in my opinion. And so I think feedback from investors and sponsors have really found this ground. And it can shift depending on a deal and the risk profile, of course. But for a lot of real estate deals, look, we want to have a preferred return where we prioritize our investors each year, you know, before we take anything as a sponsor. And so that's really helpful. And a split on the back end, that certainly ensures that the sponsor is motivated to succeed and maximize profits. And another piece there, you know, it's the co-investment, you know, everyone says is really, I mean, as an LP, you should invest with any sponsor or deal that they have less than 5% co-investment. But, you know, I think something that we do that's a little bit unique to a lot of deals out there is how we use financing. And we're very consistently using full recourse debt. And so I think that sets us apart. And that's something I think every LP should ask a sponsor, right? Is this recourse debt? Is it carve out guarantees? You know, carve out, they might say we have carve out guarantees. That essentially means that they're off the hook if the deal goes down, as long as they're a good actor. Their presence, they communicate with the bank, and essentially they don't, you know, flee the country, right? That means that they can effectively manage the deal all the way to the ground without ever having any liability, we signed full recourse. And that is the principals here, the partners here at MAC Capital Partners, they signed personal liability on the loan. So I think that's really influential for a lot of people, especially with more experience, as they look at that and they go, okay, there's a lot more skin in the game than just the 5% co-invest. That's great, right? You should have money right alongside at the same terms as your LPs. Everyone should, again, minimum 5%. If they say it's less than that, you know, it better be a huge deal and a reason that they don't. But that being said, you know, having tens of millions of dollars in recourse liability on these deals, it really keeps an operator from taking undue risk, right? You really look at that as just you yourself, right? You stop thinking about other people's money and you really start to think, hey, do I feel comfortable investing in this? And I think that's important. Not to say that anyone here or other sponsor groups think like that all the time, but it's just a great barrier. It's a bulwark against getting a little too over your skis and starting to deploy capital just to add to your AUM, right? Or just to fill up a fund. That makes every operator think twice when you're signing personally. I mean, that affects your family. So it really tells me when I look at deals, when a sponsor signs recourse, that, hey, you really live and breathe this. You're walking the walk, not just talking the talk.
Well, Drew, I admire a lot of what MAC Capital Partners is doing. I think you all have a really interesting business model and really appreciative that you were able to take the time out and spend this time with me today. If listeners want to connect with you, learn more about MAC Capital Partners, where would you like to send people?
Yeah, they can go to our website, magcp.com, or they can email me, drew@magcp.com. And reach out to me directly. Happy to chat with anyone who wants to learn a little bit more.
I'd also recommend getting on your email list. I'm on the email list and you guys are super active. I think you send out a monthly newsletter and there's always this huge list of all the places that you're going to be all around the country. You all do a lot of in-person events. You attend conferences and I know you're going to be at the Best Ever conference. And so listeners should definitely watch out for your booth if they're going to be attending a conference. Drew, thank you so much for joining me. Sincerely appreciate your time today. Listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to reach out to either one of us. We love talking about commercial real estate, industrial real estate, sale leasebacks. We would love to talk to you. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
This content is for entertainment and informational purposes only. It is not financial advice, and it is not an invitation to buy or sell real estate or make any investment decisions.